Welcome to the Narrator Roundtable. I'm Kurt Graves. I'm joined today by two of my co-hosts, Andre Santana. Hello, Andre. How are you?
Hey, Kurt. Doing great.
Good. Glad to have you. And Lindsay Dorcas. Welcome.
Hi, Kurt. So excited to finally be able to join you. It's good.
Yay. Excellent. All right. So let me set the scene. It's the week before APAC 2023. Flights have been booked. Hotel rooms have been reserved. Outfits appropriate for the first professional event I've attended since the pandemic and the waistline I acquired during the pandemic have been purchased. I'm ready. I'm excited. And then I get the dreaded text. My emotional support narrator has COVID. She won't be coming. I'm on my own. For the record, Lindsay is my emotional support narrator. The silver lining? Lindsay has a ticket to Sasha Velour's Nightgowns taking place the Sunday before APAC. Would I like her ticket? Do rose petals cascade like a velvet waterfall from a drag queen's wig? Of course I want that ticket. I inherit not only her ticket, but her date for the event. Another narrator named Jeremy. Great, I think. I'm sure if Lindsay likes him, we'll get along. Cut to Sunday evening. I receive a message, not from the dandy gentleman I am expecting, but a stunning redhead with an infectious smile. She is my date. We fight through a maelstrom of sweaty narrators clinging to their complimentary cocktails and room temperature appetizers until, at last, we are united. Platonic homosexual sparks fly. A friendship is forged in the heat of a really freaking hot ballroom. We make it out of the conference hotel and hop a train to Brooklyn. We arrive at the very last minute for the showtime listed on our tickets, and then wait for 2 hours outside the venue until the drag queens are ready, because they will not be rushed, damn it. But it's great. We chat. We find out how much we have in common. We share a $30 tray of nuts and cured meats. Honestly, it's probably the best first date I've ever had. And when it's all over, I have not only a new friend, but a treasured colleague. Someone whose talent I admire and upon whose candor I will come to depend. And it's all thanks to Lindsay. And like many narrators, we establish a small cohort to keep in touch, share our successes, exchange encouragement, and trade war stories. And one day, a series of messages go back and forth, and I think, we need to make this a podcast. Oh, wait, I'm making one of those. Seriously, guys, let's make this an episode of our podcast. And so that's what we're doing today. Jeremy Carlisle Parker is an actor, singer, and award-winning audiobook narrator living and working in New York. She has been featured in film and television and performed in regional theaters across the U.S. She has a profound love of storytelling and firmly believes that books can change lives. Jeremy, thank you for joining us at the Narrator Roundtable. Welcome.
Oh, thank you so much. That whole intro, I am not worthy of such beauty. Oh, it got me all collapsed.
You are.
It's so beautiful. I loved our meet cute.
It was a meet cute.
It was. It was a meet cute followed by the terror overwhelm of too many people. Thank goodness.
Yes. Anyone who was at APAC 2023 can relate to trying to find somebody in that room on Sunday night.
Just a sea of terror-filled eyes. It's like that SpongeBob episode where, what are those, the anchovies? Just all eyeballs and mouths open and being like,
You've lost me. I'm too old.
Oh, well, me too. I just was a babysitter. So that's how I know the sponge.
Well, welcome. We're so excited to have you here. And like I said, we're just going to basically begin with that first conversation we had through text message. And that series of messages really began with an observation from Lindsay. So I'm going to ask her to share with everyone what she said that day.
Sure. I don't remember the exact phrasing, I'm sure, but it was one of those moments when I was working in the booth and it was a very high interruption day. I was getting lots of noise from outside, things outside of my control, stumbling over my words. And it was a really emotional scene that I had to get recorded that day. And I remember thinking, I am so grateful for my theater training in this moment, because that technique was everything and really allowed me to jump back into these really difficult, high emotion, high intensity moments without having to do something special to like ramp up into it and without being too precious about it, which is something I struggle with as an actor sometimes, being like, oh, everything must be perfect. Like the temperature must be right and I must be in the right mood and I must be like perfect. My body and my voice and everything must be perfect, or like that special alchemy isn't going to happen. And it was a lovely reminder that like, yeah, some of it is magic. Some of it is alchemy. Some of it is, you know, the spirit and the ether, but a lot of it is technique. And my theater training with my theater professor in college always made us like jump in the middle of scenes when we were working on something. She often wouldn't let us like, oh, go all the way back to the beginning and then try it again. She'd be like, no, start here, start in the middle. And she's like, you have to practice doing this because as an actor, film, theater, audiobooks, whatever, you're going to have to jump in the middle of things because other stuff is happening around you. And practicing that was so valuable. And then I was able to be like, yeah, you know what? Shit is happening around me. Stuff is happening around me. But you know what? I have this technique. I have this practice. I can jump right in.
I don't know everybody's entire backstory, but I feel like we've all had different levels of education and different interactions with like theater training. Some of us, you know, nothing formal. Others, a lot of formal training. And then varying levels of experiences of actual like onstage work. So like, Jeremy, do you remember how that hit you when Lindsay sent that and some of how you replied?
No. I mean, I remember the discussion.
How did it hit you now then?
No, I remember how it was like one of those moments where, I remember the conversation because it struck me and it was a callback to like, I kind of know both worlds. Not to go too much into backstory, but I used to be an opera singer and I trained as one for three degrees. And I also was I was always early on singing with some kind of injury, either nodular thickness or I had a hemorrhage blood vessel that I eventually had to have surgery to repair. And I remember those days of like, I have a checklist so long that must be met in order for me to be able to phonate and do my work tomorrow, do my auditions. It was a prison that I lived in of like, okay, I have to have 8 hours, 8 to 10 hours of sleep. I have to sleep facing my humidifier blowing on me all night. I wake up and it looks like a jungle in here. I have to drink this much water. I can't go to a loud place and eat. I can't, or talk with my friends. I have to go on vocal rest after a certain point. A lot of that was injury, but it was also just like, again, as Lindsay says, being precious, wanting to have the optimum environment situation, even just like bodily function, I guess. We are an instrument. It is an athletic thing that we do in our vocal production. To meet those markers, to know that I could feel confident in the performance that I was delivering. And then realizing that like, oh yeah, no, actually, we don't need that. We don't need to check those boxes. Actually, leaning into our imperfection, the huskiness that we can have from day to day, some of the fatigue we experience moving through the world, just being human beings in a world that's hard and scary, like that sometimes elicits some of the most beautiful performances. Because they're so rooted in realism and they're so deeply relatable. And a lot of it is too, like, trusting the technique, trusting the training as you familiarize and get better with this work and feel more confident in your muscles. It is like a muscle that you can turn off and on at the drop of a hat or loud car drives by, jump back into the scene without having to be like, okay, I have to go into sense memory. I have to go into this triggering memory of mine or emotion to find that flow again. And it's liberating. It's wonderful. I loved breaking out of the prison of my own making when it came to like checking those boxes for me to give the optimized performance. It actually also doesn't exist. So right. There's that.
Well, and when it came time to transition that lesson you learned as an opera singer to your work as an audiobook narrator, was it an effortless transition, or did you have to kind of relearn that lesson with a different art form?
I did, actually, to be honest, because long form is really hard. And so just the logistics and the athleticism of sitting in a booth and working and delivering, you know, two finished hours a day, or, you know, hopefully more, you know, it took a lot of time. And I found myself like falling back. It took a lot of time to realize, well, it's conditioning. There is some of that. That's just logistical. But it took a bit of time for me to kind of shake out of the like former self in me that still lives in me, of like opera singer me being like, oh no, I can't go get a drink with my friend after whatever this rehearsal, because I have to be in the studio tomorrow, and or I have to get this much done. And you know, you want to not be foolish with your instrument, but there is, I can still deliver like grounded, authentic, and well-performed material without having to clutch to these, I don't know, guardrails of my own making, if that makes sense.
Andre, as somebody who is entering this conversation, hearing some of this for the first time, how is it hitting you?
It's so funny because there's two levels for this conversation. One that's kind of like, I think we all think about it, and two that's like super personal to me that I'm navigating like right now. And one is that I think this is like a fundamental skill in what we do because of the punch and roll format. I think that like there's a lot of people who, you know, and I haven't been on stage, this is completely theoretical, check me if it's wrong, I think if you're in a format where you're encouraged to roll with mistakes and not make a moment of like resetting, then having to be word perfect and like stopping and having to go back a sentence, I can imagine really messes with you, especially when you're making mistakes repeatedly. And I know folks who get so stressed if they're working with a director about like, oh my God, like I'm going to do the same line 6 times and someone's going to see it and it's going to be terrible. And I think that kind of buzz is a process of, like you said, like you find the note, you make the mistake, and you come back up to the note again. Because if it's going to take you 5 minutes to get back in the mindset after every punch and roll, the format isn't really saving you any time at that point. So I think that's one piece. The other piece for me is like, I've been uber struggling with ADHD and like working from home alone. And I think like what's great is being in the space and doing the work. Like once it happens, it's clear. But I think for me, one of the things that I've been really pushing myself to do is like ask for exactly what I need. And sometimes like absolutely love this booth I got behind me, and I've recorded God knows how much in there, and I will record God knows how much in there. But I also live around the corner from a police station, and I live in a gigantic New York City apartment building. And the types of distractions sometimes aren't just about like pulling yourself back from a moment of stepping away. And I think it becomes another battle of not just getting yourself back into the act, but also like tamping down the frustration that develops or the fear and concern that develops. And so I've been like more frequently asking for studio time when it's possible, because not just like, oh my God, like I'm going to go in studio, but like it's a focused space for me. Like, you know, and at the very least, if there are interruptions, like I know it is in a way not in my hands. Like I don't have to carry the anxiety of the interruptions, and I can focus on my acting and I can focus on my work. And when that's not possible, to ask for a director, because I think that just like being present with someone else who's also kind of here with the artistry, like a director who's going to be patient and supportive and all those great things, I think just gives me permission to take on the process, to like, oh, there's a car going by. Like, that's great. That's cool. Someone's here. The car isn't going to like pull me away to TikTok for half an hour while I'm waiting for the honking to stop or whatever it is, that someone is there to like support me in the process and is that quiet voice of saying like, all right, like let's step back into it. So I think those have been the pieces for me about this conversation is like, how do I manage this on like both the micro level, but also like the macro level too?
I very much relate to the ADHD of it all. I'm a very high functioning ADHD person, and I didn't get diagnosed until late in life. Because a lot of the things that I have learned I need to be productive were things that were provided for me when I was younger. Structure, routine, somebody to measure myself against, like competition or classmates or coworkers, whatever it is. Some motivational factor that is external. You know, those are all things that exist in school and in a traditional job. And so, like, those are the things that kept me focused and kept me going. When I transitioned to working for myself and doing this work, and it is so isolated, that ability to come back to a moment was nearly impossible when I first started, because every little distraction became an explosion for me. It was because I did have that reaction of like a car horn honked. Oh, well, there goes my afternoon. And it's like, all right, dude, we have to address some things. And I did not have the training that a lot of my acting buddies have had. So I haven't had that the experience of having a director reinforce a more positive reaction to distractions. I had to just kind of learn through trial and error that like, get over it, dude. You know, and through conversations with colleagues who share really inspiring and wise words with me, things, you know, like Jeremy, what you were just saying really struck me about not having to feel like it has to be perfect, that actually there is great beauty in the imperfection of it, in the humanity that we bring to the work. I'm focusing and working on that actually right now in the booth of not stopping every single time that I don't, you know, when a word kind of gets swallowed at the end of a sentence, like sometimes it's okay, especially if it's dialogue, just let it go, just keep going. And I'm like, if at the end of the process, somebody's like, oh, I couldn't understand that, they'll let you know. There's somebody whose job it is to do that, to check you on those sorts of things, but to just stay in the moment and keep going, those are hard. Those were hard lessons for me to learn over these 7 years.
Yeah. And that's something I had to get used to moving from theater to audiobooks, is that working solo part. Because like you said, Andre, I've only been able to go into studio like four times in like the 125 plus books I've done. Four times I've been in studio. But every time I am so much more productive. I'm so much more efficient. And it is such, and it's such a joyful process, because I can let go of the directing part of my brain. I can let go of the engineering part of my brain, and I can just be an actor, and I can trust my director, and I can just like live in the story, and I can narrate. And it's really tough to move from a very like collaborative acting art form to one that is so like, so that's why like reminding myself to just like putting the voice of my acting teacher in my head, being like, just go, just go, just dive in. Because it's so easy for me to get caught up in like this, you know, in the sounds and the direction and thinking, is this right? Is this good? Am I doing this well? Like Kurt was talking about, like, could I do that better? And like Jeremy said, at a certain point, you have to be like, I'm a human being and I am bringing my humanness to this story. And whatever my first instinct was probably right. And I need to keep going. Because also like we're in an art form where you don't get to like marinate and really think about it. Like when I would be rehearsing a play, I would hang out with it for like a month. You're like spending a month or more before anyone else sees it, before any audience members see it, before it's the final thing. You were just like, let me like think about this, and let me like think about every word, and let me like listen to music and like think about my process and like be in a room with a bunch of other people and collaborate on this thing until like it is in your fucking bones. By the time you are doing it in front of an audience, it is like instinctual almost. It is like you have just like marinated in the sauce of this story forever. But with audiobooks, we don't have that luxury to like really be like, I'm just going to like spend a month just thinking about one book before I narrate it. That's not how it works. We gotta keep it moving. So you become even more reliant. Nice. What?
Wouldn't that be nice?
Would it be so nice?
But also, I want to counter that just a little bit. I just want to offer an interesting perspective, because don't we struggle when we're those of us who have a background in theater or like in an opera? When I was in school, I was rehearsing the opera for 3 entire months. I was in coachings, just singing it for 2, then a month of staging for usually only 2 performances. But don't you think sometimes, while it's wonderful, I'm not saying we should change the model of rehearsal or change, but you think about these, living in New York, being in the center of commercial theater, these people who learn a show in 2 days and then go on as swings. And while that is terrifying, I think sometimes it can hold us back a little bit when something is so second nature to us, then we have a hard time finding freshness in it, finding authenticity, finding that everybody want, like, not the conversational read, that's commercial view, but you know, that like, oh, I want it to feel real, or oh, I want to feel like you're saying this for the first time. And for those of us, like, you know, those of us that do this work, we have more ability to do that because we don't have it would be wonderful to know the material more intimately and live with it longer, because it is going to beget, you know, maybe some different performances, better or worse, who knows? But there's also, like, I think sometimes we're a little hard on ourselves because there is something that is just so beautifully human about taking it and being like, this is my instinct on this, and this, I feel like this is right, and I should trust this, rather than trying to sit there and, I mean, I'm a 10-take Tina over here. When I was doing this, I would do every line 10 times. And then I'd go back and listen and be like, nah, it was 1 always. And so giving ourselves permission, not to like shoot you down, Lindsay, but I'm also like, but this is also like, there's just so, I think sometimes we don't take all of what we're given, because also it's the punch and roll model that's hard. And also dealing with environments that we're not being stopped by a director. We're not being stopped by someone who's saying this is a misread. We're being stopped by literally life. And we don't know when they're going to let, like, when life is going to let us work again, which is another frustration. And then pulling ourselves out of that, like, stop and frustration, anger, you know, to be able to be like, okay, acting, let's do it, I guess, after there was a jackhammer outside for 4 hours and I didn't know about it. Anyway, rambling, sorry.
No, and it's so funny because actually I don't think, like, for me, in my experience, you're not contradicting at all. Because listen, I am like an anxious little rabbit. And for me, preparation is freeing. And so, like, I know other people would, but I didn't struggle so much with like, oh, it's getting stale. We've done the same thing over and over again. Because I knew, like, okay, I know enough. I know my blocking. I know my lines. That is in here. Then I get to play. Then it's like, okay, all that is set. Now I can just like be in the moment and react more instinctively and be more connected, because I'm not worrying about like, oh, did I say the wrong word? Did I do the wrong thing? Nope. We already worked through that. Now I'm here. And so it's like similar with audiobooks where like, you don't need as much preparation, not just because of how it works, but also like you have the words in front of you and you don't need to memorize anything. You don't need to like have that level of coordination with a bunch of other actors. You do all that prep beforehand. But then trusting your instincts is like part of the fun and part of the art.
Yeah.
Yeah. Some of what you're saying is just making me think about permission in a weird way. I've always said that I am an introvert who's comfortable in the spotlight, because I don't typically like to be like the out there person at like a party. But like, if a spotlight is present, that means 1, we've practiced. 2, I am supposed to be talking. 3, everybody else is supposed to be paying attention to me. This is a constructed, I have permission in a situation with a spotlight to be the one taking up the room. I have had to learn to give myself permission in the booth to be the one that people are paying attention to, which is hard to do when there's actually nobody else there. And the only permission you've been given is an email saying, hey, will you record this book? And it's all on you now. Go. So it was just making me think about like the permission we have to give ourselves to just do it. And if you're like me and felt that that was always an external thing, that permission came from somewhere else, you gotta stop that. But also earlier, what we were talking about had me thinking about the different roles that we play in the booth when we are doing a self-record. The difference between working at home and working in a studio. I have never had the pleasure of working in a studio. I'm sure I would love it, but I've always thought about like, oh, I need my process as a narrator needs to grow and I need to get better as a narrator. And in talking in this discussion, I'm realizing that part of what I had to do was actually be a better director to myself. Mm. We are all playing three roles when we do a self-record. We are the narrator, we are the director, and we are the engineer. I'm good at the narration part. It was the directing part that I needed to get better at. I needed to get better at motivating myself. I needed to get better at giving myself permission. And I needed to get better at providing encouragement when things are going well. And the support, like Andre was saying, like having another person in the room to say, like, we're not going to walk away for a half an hour just because a car honked. Like, we'll wait 2 minutes and we'll come right back. That was the person I wasn't being for myself. And I had to learn how to do that.
Yeah. And I think, too, like, the things that I see that manifesting as for me and for other people, one was, you know, you're early on in your audiobook narration, your recording ratio is super high, and you're like, where is all that time going? What's going on? And it's because you're doing 15 takes and you're like not trusting your first choice on, you know, like a lot of what Jeremy was saying earlier about trusting your instincts. And there's a conversation to be had. Maybe this is tangential about like narrators doing their own positron checking before they send off their audio. Well, we can circle back to that in a second too. But I think that like there's a huge piece about being the director. And one thing I notice with some of my favorite directors too is that absolutely some of my favorite directors give me like these little performance suggestions here and then, like things I might not have thought or emphases that I might have like misread. But some of the best support they've offered me is, you know, if I'm engineering at home and they're still directing and I do a read and then I go back and like do another take and they're like, no, the first one was better. Let's keep that and we're going to keep going. To have someone just like reaffirm actually that the choice you made was a strong choice too.
Yeah, I've had that experience. Well, I want to shout out. I don't know if she'll listen, but I owe a lot to. I was able to very, very early I was at a point where I was really out of my depth, to be honest, and probably shouldn't have been doing the books that I was doing. But I got a chance to, only because that's just me being like, oh, I could have done so much better because I was just so green, right? And when you're in a directed session with someone. And I did my first several like at home. Well, I would go to Virginia or Ohio to do them because my home studio was like garbage mama. I lived between JFK and LaGuardia and it was just a nightmare. But I worked with the director on many, many projects in it, like right after one another, very early in my journey. And I realized working with her, like how cruel I was being to myself as a director when it was just me, how hard I was being on myself, even with her too, like it, because it's another person. And her name is Garrett Scott. I love her. I'll never forget. It was my first ever directed session on a huge, epic fantasy, book by a beloved author who I already felt like everyone's going to hate me because I'm not, a few famous narrators who narrated the other series before, you know, already felt like I was coming up from under rather than meeting the material at the same level. And I would get so angry and take myself out of the moment every take. And there were a lot of takes because I wasn't, I mean, it takes time to get smooth. It takes time to find flow. I sometimes still struggle with that. It just depends on the writing. Sometimes it's like, oh, these words came from some like soul that exists within me. And sometimes it's harder. And I would stop and I would beat myself up and I would try not to swear because I didn't want it to end up like accidentally in the audio. And she told me, she was like, never apologize. No one's counting your misreads. No one cares. That's not real. And if it is real for some like post friends or whatever, like that's not your problem. Don't apologize. Don't get angry. Everything is hinged in your breath. Like your character, your emotions, your humanity is in your breath. So take a breath and take two if you need, and then meet the material again. Which I still struggle. I'm not perfect, but I can never thank her enough for telling me that early in the process. You know, because you hear about narrators who like don't ever have pickups. And I'm like, oh my God, if I have a lot of pickups, I'll never work again. And it's like, that's just so silly. And I think too, like just as directors at home, I mean, it's such a gift, such a luxury, such a, I mean, dream of an experience to be able to work in studio. I consider myself incredibly privileged to live in a market that has them available, you know, in New York City. And it's hard to like have that and then come home and be with yourself and then not, you know, be so such a cruel director. You know, learn to trust yourself without that outside perspective. Yeah. But we all know it. We have it. You know what I mean? If that makes sense, we're all really good at, we're good at this. We're good actors. We're good humans. And, you know, we can trust that what we're putting into this and is a reflection of a human experience that is valid and should be heard. That makes sense.
I didn't think this conversation would veer into pickups as much as it has, but it's Sorry. So, it is a part of staying present, because I am one of those narrators who used to be really proud of the fact that I would only get a few pickups for a book. But what I realized over time is I was spending too much of my brain energy worrying about accuracy, and I wasn't letting myself experience the story, or I had to work a lot harder to experience the story. As I continued to do this and I learned, I had more fun in the booth. I think I was putting out better work, but I was getting more pickups because I wasn't stopping myself as I read. I just didn't care about that anymore. And I, again, had to remind myself, this is somebody's job to catch those things. Like, there is a proofer down the line. They're going to do their job. I have to trust that they're going to do a good job. And they'll let me know. And it's not a slight if I get back 2, 3, 4 times as many pickups as I'm used to, because my thinking as a narrator shouldn't be about accuracy. It should be about performance and storytelling. So I don't know. Does that transition into a conversation about Positron, Andre? I'm really curious what that's about.
Well, let's do it. Let's do a, like a soft transition too, because I was gonna say also about pickups. Like, there's so many different spectrums of it in terms of like what it represents about your focus. Like, I've had projects under an hour and a half where I've gotten like 80 pickups, and I go back and I'm like, where did these come from? What do these mean? I had one project that I did that was 4 hours long. It was my favorite. This year was one of my favorite books that I've ever recorded, probably my favorite character I've ever done. And I remember waiting for the pickups. And then the sample went up on Chirp Books. And I emailed the editor and I was like, did I miss like a pickup email from you? And he's like, no, you didn't have any pickups on like a 4-hour project. That'll never happen again. But that was like, that felt like this kind of correlation. And similarly, stuff that I've loved where I've gotten, like, you know, my metric that I'm always not always checking, I'm trying not to like be super focused on it, but like everyone's like about 15 pickups per hour or something like that, which like, I don't know who that represents. I don't think that's been me recently either, but I think it's all over the place. And I agree with Kurt too. I think that like what's so revealing about audiobooks is when you really break down what all the roles and responsibilities are in the production process. I've been training as a director recently, and learning about like script markup has changed my mindset and how I talk to other folks who are about to work with a director for the first time about like what it means to work with a director. Like, you know, if we're doing an open role, there's a director, we make mistakes. They're marking how many mistakes that we've made on the same punch in or the same line, because the editor is just going to skip over all of those and cut them right out and move on with their life, right? And what you said about apologizing, right? Like, no one is going to do a top to bottom perfect read of a book. You made a mistake. You read something. We know for a fact, like I was on Facebook in 2012. You've seen all those posts that are like, if you can read this, you're secretly a genius. And like, it's all misspelled words in the middle. Like, we know that our brains do a ton of stuff in terms of prediction and rearrangement with words. And so it's human to make those mistakes, and they will show up in pickups. It's why the process exists. And so that's to say, there is someone in the process, a good audiobook process will have someone in the process who is going to listen back, who's going to find those mistakes, who's going to send them back to you. Someone else is going to cut them in. And I think that like, I'm not claiming this as any kind of like epidemic. I think I've only talked to a couple folks about it. I'm curious if y'all have kind of seen it as well. But pickups before you've sent off raw audio, narrators who have their own Positron subscription when doing like publisher work, right? Someone else is doing post-production. And for me, one, it feels like it's kind of like folks who like mouth declick raw audio before they send it off. It feels like, one, there's this kind of like false threshold of what we think raw audio is supposed to be. And two, someone else, this is a part of the process. Someone else in the, you know, in the production line is meant to be taking these steps for and with us, because we are all being compensated for different parts of the job. And it hasn't, and I say this personally because I think there's been a couple of folks I've talked to who have shared their own approach to it, and it just hasn't resonated to me, the idea that I as the narrator should be doing pickups before my raw audio has been sent off, right?
Well, because I mean the operative word there should. There's nothing saying you should be doing that. I guess the only thing I would say in defense of somebody who does that is, if it allows you to be more free in the booth and allows you to tell the story better because you have in the back of your mind the security blanket of knowing that like you're going to check it, nobody's going to see it. If that would truly be devastating to your process and it is worth that time and money, okay. I would be sad that I was losing that income. You know, because it's not a free service. So you are, whatever you're making from the publisher, they're paying you just for your narration because they've figured the cost of proofing into the back end. So I would be sad to lose that money.
And that time of like doing multiple rounds of pick, because you're not going to catch 100% necessarily. Even doing like that Positron run through.
Right.
I mean, like, let's say you said Tamara and your co-narrator said Tamara. You're still going to have pick, like, stuff is still going to come back. So you've just created like two rounds of work for yourself, which we don't have to, nobody has time for that. We don't have time for that. And I would say like, if it is, a security blanket, like that, those are useful. Trust, you know, like we all have them. We all have the things that like make us feel better about our process. But I would, you know, if that's what it is for somebody, I would encourage them to then like examine their initial process and see like how they can free themselves from that need to like turn in, pick up less audio. Or if they are getting an excessive number of pickups, like, you know, every other word is a pickup, like 10 pickups per page consistently, then it might be worth going like, what am I doing in my initial process that means that I'm like having that much trouble with the initial text? And like, what can you do to address that?
Yeah.
But I also want to acknowledge yes to both of those, but I also, I know you didn't say this explicitly, but I think the slippery slope with this too is, are we setting a new bar or threshold and a new set of responsibilities on us when we are already now, listen, the home record model is wonderful for folks that, I mean, people have home studios, they don't have to be anchored in, you know, the coastal cities in order to do this work, which has been such a wonderful thing. That's why we're seeing so much new talent. And, but it's also, I think, in just so many looming things about the future of our work, which I know that's a whole other conversation, but like, and then this like clamoring to like carve out a place in the world and in the industry. And it's like, if I can be no pickup, I'm, you know, perfection, then maybe that's something that can, you know, that I can use or leverage or what have you. I worked with someone who told me that if I could get word perfect in my reads, then all the engineers would talk about me and hire me for books and like last minute projects when they knew they wouldn't have to do any work to fix the audio because I read it perfectly. And then I talked to one of my coaches or one of my directors who literally cackled in my face and was like, that's not real. Like the author doesn't know how many pickups we're getting. And guess who's hiring us at the end of the day? The authors are the ones who are picking the voices to tell their stories. And they honestly know nothing about the process. Like, I mean, I'm sure they know some. But often, you know, they don't even know if the narrator they asked for got it until it, you know what I mean? There can be such little communication. But like at the end of the day, those are the folks that are deciding who tells their stories, and they don't know what our pickup numbers are. And that doesn't detract, like what they are, they're completely unaware of that. They just want what is going to serve the text and their stories and their characters with the most heart, humanity, and human experience, especially in these days, especially in this kooky, crazy world we're living in, where we're fighting for our lives and our rights to be, you know, artists and storytellers and creative people. And
producer I've ever talked to has mentioned the value of a few to no pickups. I've ever talked to has talked about what Lindsay said, which is careless mistakes, which are not fixed by a positron report. Because if the issue is a mispronunciation or a miscommunication between co-narrators, that's not fixed by positron. But those are the things that producers will remember if they happen time and time again.
Exactly. But they're not looking at those numbers. They just want them done. Like, that's all. They're just like, just do the pickups and then we can wrap and get it ready for sale. We don't care. Just do them.
Yeah.
So.
And I think like in the context of what you're saying, Jeremy, about the humanity that authors are looking for, in these times, and timestamp for the audio, the SAG-AFTRA contract voting has just started today. I think that like, what's the full circle piece in this conversation for me is feeling human in a number of ways. One, in the booth, making mistakes, feeling human in that we make mistakes and acknowledging those things. But two, feeling knowledgeable enough, prepared enough, connected enough to my character and my text that I can roll back into that, like refocus in on that. And in talking about, you know, the things that I'm asking for and looking for to like feel focused and connected, like, you know what one thing I love about going into studio, and Kurt, I think you also technically get this, I have a commute. If I turn my camera right now that way, my bed is there. I'm at my desk and here's my booth behind me. And being able to like be like, one, oh my God, someone's going to be there, right? Which works with like remote directing too. But two, like I'm gonna put on a little outfit. I'm going to get out of the house. I'm going to go take the subway and I'm gonna, you know, and then at the end of the day, and then I'm going to do it again tomorrow. I'm not saying that people were designed for the 9-to-5. That's not what I'm saying. But I think that, again, what Kurt was saying about like routine, expectation, process. I think
external motivation.
External motivation. I think all of those things just feel consistent. They feel stabilizing. And I think in the booth too, like, last year, I wasn't full time. I was kind of recording inconsistently. And when, you know, a period of time comes by where I haven't recorded in a couple weeks and then I'm back in the booth, there is that like really steep readjustment, like not just the like getting smooth into the book, but getting smooth back into narrating, remembering all the kind of like second nature things about punch and roll, all those pieces. And I think that the ability to have that kind of like procedural consistency just feels calming and connective.
Yeah, you're absolutely right that I am a quote unquote home narrator, but I have an office outside of my home where my booth is for exactly that reason. I need the routine of getting up, leaving the house. That is my workspace. This is my home. The two are separate.
And I'm looking into renting, trying to find a way to remove my studio space from my home because of focus issues. Because of, I mean, there is ritual and in you know, in leaving and going to work, right? There's also healthy distance. What I struggle with are boundaries, and it's like I work from home and the work never ends and there's always work to do. So how dare I watch Dragula while I eat dinner when I could be prepping a book, you know, like I mean, I struggle with the home model too. I hear everything that you're saying, Andre, and I'm like, oh, are we the same person? Because it's hard. That's some of the pitfalls of the home model and the home records and the self-direct punch and roll on your own.
So in each episode, we take questions from listeners, and this week we have an anonymous submission. The question reads, I was an audiobook listener long before I became a narrator. I think we can probably all relate to that. And I always rated and reviewed the audiobooks I enjoyed. Now, though, I worry that it's inappropriate to be passing judgment on my colleagues. It feels like if you were asked to peer review a coworker and then the review was posted publicly. Is that a concern others share, or am I being silly?
I'm terrified of this all the time, so yes.
What, terrified of being reviewed or terrified of being a reviewer?
A reviewer. I was also like a rabid listener before I became an audiobook narrator, and I reviewed everything. And once I started narrating, out of respect, I did like private some of my reviews or like remove the text of some of my more critical reviews. And I think like two things I've done, like one, again, I privated everything. Like my Goodreads is closed and you can only see what I post on Goodreads if I've like written a text review out. And like even my I rarely use Audible, but when I do buy an Audible book, like it's not my name on there. And similarly, I'm only like writing something out in text if I really want to like uplift and celebrate. And it leads to two things, which is like, one, I don't find myself listening to a lot of audiobooks I dislike, unless it's like part of the audiobook book club that I'm in. I feel like the the samples usually give me a good projection of where we're going. But two is like, I'll share reviews. If there's something negative, if I have a negative thought about it, like, I've been in that position. I'm not their coach. I don't know what their like process and approach was. I'm not going to share it. And similarly, I also have an understanding of like how review systems work. And so for me, I'm like detractive. Like I give, if I like something and I think it's solid, I give it 5 stars. And then if I really like it, it's just 6 stars in my head because we can't give 6 stars on whatever platform. And I'll occasionally give like a 4-star if I feel, but like 3-star and beyond, that to me is like, I don't need to put that out into the world. And again, for me, it's partially just like, I know I'm not your coach. I know how reviews impact all of these things. And so I don't want to contribute negatively to that process because I also know that some other people will love this. And the final thing I'll say is it leads me, I am the kind of person who loves to lean into what artists intend. I will like walk away from some of the cheesiest movies ever and be like, that's my movie of the year. Loved that. If you haven't seen Theater Camp, please watch Theater Camp. That was also very like well received though. So that's not necessarily a great example, but, so I'll listen to an audiobook and I'll be like, like 10 out of 10. And then I will go and write the gushiest possible review where I'll say the narrator's name as many times as possible and be like, let's celebrate other people. Like let's share the joy together, you know?
Yeah, I'm with you. I was not an avid reviewer before I started doing this work. Like when I listened to audiobooks or other things, I usually wouldn't take the time to sit down and like type out an Audible review or like post a review on Goodreads. I would just be like, that was very good. And maybe I'd mention it to my friend and like that, you know, that's sort of it. So I'm not coming from a place of like having to change my behavior. But now especially, it's certainly not a practice I'm going to start, except in the sense, as you mentioned it, Andre, if I have like an incredibly positive review, I might post that to like cheer on that person, that colleague, to celebrate them, to be like, hey, I listened to this and it was amazing. You should feel very proud of your work. And I might share that on like social media or something if I listen to an audiobook that I loved and shout out the narrator and the author and be like, you know, come get your flowers. Like, because what we do is so isolated and so isolating that that positive feedback, when it does come along, does mean a lot, you know, to be like, oh my God, somebody listened and they enjoyed it. Oh, thank God. Like it's, you know, so I know how important that is. But similarly, like if I listen to something and it's just not for me, for any number of reasons, like that's nobody's business but mine. And if I want to talk to my friends privately about that, if I want to like, you know, have like you would about any piece of media, have a discussion with other people, great, just about like that media. But because I'm in this industry now, I don't think it's appropriate for me to be like, you know, to be like you said, I'm not your coach. It's not my job to critique you. And I firmly believe that, listen, while I do read my reviews, I know some people don't. I have a little actor ego. I need that boost. Sometimes it's a dangerous boost because the bad reviews will also be there. So it's like playing Russian roulette every time. I'm like, is this going to be okay?
And yes, anonymous friend, you're not being silly at all. I also want to like applaud this person for awareness. Like that's really quite lovely in a world where it's like, I hated it. I have to tell everyone. On every platform, because I also, not only am an actor, I come from the service industry and live and die in my job by Yelp. Gotta love that. So I have feelings about reviews, but still read them anyway, because some days, you know, just want to beat myself up. But I think, yes, review, like, as Lindsay said, this is like so, we are so siloed in this work. And we're siloed with ourselves. So we gotta like ourselves. You know, but it's also like, unless you're lucky to be reviewed by Audiophile or maybe get, you know, a library journal, something, you know, or get press on a book. And a lot of the work, a lot of the stuff that we put out, we never know what people think, or not that their opinions necessarily matter, but it can certainly help us help inform how, It can help affirm our instincts. It can help affirm us in this work. It can help us train our director to be kinder to ourselves, especially when they are, you know, when they are good reviews that shout us out and like things that people enjoy or that had an impact, especially for those books that like are, as Bailey Carr says, are soul books, you know, that we really like love and felt like, I don't know, we were just as a match made in heaven made for it. And so, yeah, like I welcome that. I think that is a wonderful thing. And I also was not, I'm not a reviewer. It's just not my, that's not my jush. But I appreciate them. And I think having the mindfulness and yeah, like just if it's critical, since we're colleagues, like, you know, keep that for your circles and keep that. We have enough, there are enough reviewers. And I do think that critical reviews are important. They're not for us. They're for other consumers. They are for consumers to talk about the book and decide if they want to purchase it or not or whatever. And that is absolutely fine. And it's par for the course. And, you know, none of us are for everyone. Most of us are not for most people, but for the people that we are for, ooh, we are for them.
Reviews are for readers. Reviews are for listeners. Reviews are for consumers. Mm. So it is consumers speaking to other consumers. It's saying, I bought this product and this was my experience with it. If you are thinking about buying this product, here is some information. And like we've seen before, sometimes even a negative review can be something that causes somebody to buy the book. You know, like... We're all queer narrators. I'm sure we've all gotten a review on at least one of our books that's like, there's gay people in this book.
Ew.
One, zero, one star.
I didn't know this book was about two girls.
Right. And listen, for like, a consumer who's like, that another consumer might be like, cool, that's a reason I would choose to buy that book, is that there are gay people in it.
Thank you.
So like, you know, like even the negatives can like tell somebody else. But in terms of like, you know, and again, sometimes a positive reinforcement can be really nice to get and feel for yourself. But even that, it's not even necessarily for you. It's consumers talking to each other and we're sort of like peeking in being like, what are you guys saying? And so that's why, like, I think once you are no longer primarily, we are all continue to be consumers. We all listen to audiobooks. But once you are also a producer, in addition to a consumer, I think that the reviews that you would post change.
I mean, I think I'm mostly in line with you guys. My high school drama director told me that actors don't give actors notes until their performance is perfect, and no actor's performance is perfect, which was just his long way of saying actors don't give actors notes. You know, it's not their job. So my instinct has been since I started doing this work, not to write a review, but I do rate. And my policy has always been, if I make it to the end of the book, you get 5 stars or whatever the equivalent is on that app. Like, you held my attention. I stayed till the end. If I never finish the book, I'm never going to rate it. I'm never going to review it. I don't feel the need to say 1 star because I didn't enjoy it and stopped listening. I don't understand that instinct in people. Yeah, I mean, and if you do really enjoy something, I take much more pleasure in like sending them a message personally.
Yes.
Rather than posting it publicly. I'd much rather send an email or find their website contact form or a DM in social media and just say, oh my gosh, I really loved your work in this. It's really, really good.
And especially if we're colleagues, like those reviews matter so much more than, you know, Jessica on Audible. No offense to Jessica. Love you, girl. But, you know, it's like, yeah, I think a personal reach out, that's lovely.
Agreed. I want to leave it on that note. So if you are listening and you have a question or a comment that you want us to discuss on the podcast, all you have to do is visit narratorroundtable.com and click submit a question from the main menu. And that will take you to our form where you can submit either a written question or a voice memo. And we might discuss it here on the podcast. I want to thank especially Jeremy for joining us today. Thank you so much for coming on the Narrator Roundtable. We hope you will come back.
I would love to. Thank you. This was so special. I love you three so much. I have such profound respect for the work that you do and the artists that you are and the humans that you are and the way you move through the world and the way that you lift and shine so much beauty into this industry. And this was just such a treat. Thank you so much for having me.
It was our pleasure. And obviously we feel exactly the same about you.
No, thanks, Ken.
The Narrator Roundtable is produced and hosted by Andre Santana, Deanna Anthony, Gail Shallon, Kurt Graves, and Lindsay Dorcas. All copywritten material is shared with permission. Music and sound effects are licensed through Storyblocks Audio. All opinions shared are those of the individuals and do not reflect the positions or policies of any company or organization with which they happen to be associated.